I'm Opal Palmer Adisa, and I'm here talking with Wanda Coleman, who is up in Northern California, Southern California lady, who is up. Wanda Coleman is a writer and performer. She's also a community activist, and she does volunteering for the KPFA sister station in Southern California. Her show is called The Poetry Connection. Today, what I thought we would do is talk about your poetry, how you come to your poetry, and to have you read some of your work, obviously, because I think there are lots of people who probably are familiar with you, and those who aren't, who need to hear the range of your voice, which is something that I was just really awed by when I heard you for the Jazz and Tongue series that Conceptualization did. So Wanda, let's begin by you telling us, how long have you been writing and when did you discover your voice as a poet?
Okay, well, I've been writing as a child, but actually I, you know, first published when I was in my teen years, 13, 14 years of age, in local newspapers, which encouraged me. But I actually didn't find my voice until around the time Patty Hearst was kidnapped, you know, in the mid-70s. I think I began, my voice really began to, you know, just something clicked in. And in the between the years 1974 and 1978, I really see those as significant years of development for me. And I had my first book, really like book, come out from Black Sparrow Press in 1979. It was titled Mad Dog Black Lady. It's been out of print for a very long time, but it's the whole text of the book, sort of a revised text, a manuscript, is in my book, African Sleeping Sickness, which came out in 1990 and is still available. So that's about the time my voice... I knew that I was me, you
okay.
know, really, and I was very confident in that, that I wasn't imitating anyone else, and that I had that I was something finally very original, and it took a long time to feel that way.
Okay. I think that is true for most writers in terms of just developing. Why poetry? How do you see poetry as a vehicle, or how do you use poetry?
Well... poetry isn't a very effective vehicle in this society. We live in a society where language is used to manipulate and control people. And to an extent, and that poetry has been idealized and romanticized and sort of set aside as something dysfunctional or something not very important or something that you go to only at certain moments in your life that doesn't really have anything to do with everyday function. It's not a part of our daily ritual of living, and because of that, I think poetry has suffered in this country. To me, its resurgence of the oral tradition in rap has been absolutely marvelous. I think that's been really fantastic. But I think poet is probably the bastard of the arts in this country. Poets, when you leave America, poets are important people.
Mm-hmm.
They're just as important as politicians. You become a cultural ambassador as a poet. And that's really exciting to see that your work and what you have to say because you're recognized for who you are.
Exactly.
You're the carrier of the culture. You're the griot. You're the storyteller. You're the keeper. You keep the tales of the tribe. And in this country, you don't receive that kind of acknowledgement. You're put off into a little, you know, niche somewhere, a little corner, and basically ignored unless you have some sort of profound luck.
Okay. And most of us don't have luck.
Right. Most of us do not have that. And I think that's really unfortunate. And although I think it's changing, albeit too gradual for my taste, poets, I think because of the poets don't seem to mix well with the mass communications media. But I think a whole generation of media savvy younger poets are coming along who aren't afraid of using the computer or the fax machine or whatever
it takes, is necessary,
you know. And so I think that eventually is going to change significantly.
Do you think, as an African-American poet, that in your community, and certainly poets in the 60s and in all eras have been very important, I think, in various movements in African-American struggle, do you think that the perception in various African-American communities about poets and the place of poetry is very similar to the mainstream?
I think it differs slightly. I think our poets, and I would go beyond just saying poets. I think our artists, the job we've had to do and the weight we've had to carry has been significantly greater than dominant culture writers. We don't have entree. We're usually outside. The dominant cadres, they don't bless us as frequently as they do their own.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think writers who are outside the mainstream, and I'm talking about the literary mainstream in this case, which is outside the commercial writing mainstream. And I think that those of us who aren't, say, the past few decades, the pressure has been on writers to be very nice, very safe, don't say things that upset the sensibility, be apolitical.
And, whatever that
and
means.
Unfortunately, I think, especially for Black writers, that the politics goes with the turf. You're it. One of the things I frequently say when I sneeze or when I breathe or when I get up in the morning is political.
Exactly.
I can't help it. It goes with the turf. The political nature of who I am, is a visual thing. The minute you see me, the minute I go into a place, I live in a sort of borderline area between Hollywood, which is currently struggling to get out of a depressed state, and a very wealthy part of Los Angeles called Hancock Park. And there's one of these nice little European-flavored shopping areas, a street called Larchmont. And sometimes I go into the fish market there, to stock up. So I was on my way to pick up something for dinner this happened about 2 months ago. And I walked, as I stepped through the door, a 6-year-old little white boy began to scream, "It's a monster, mommy, it's a monster. It's coming to get us, mommy, mommy," and began to scream at the top of his lungs. And his mother, about a 27-year-old white female, tried to shut him up. She kept her back to, she looked, but she kept her back to me.
Mm-hmm.
She didn't offer any
apology.
No, nothing. It was like I didn't, this monster didn't exist that her son was screaming at and trying to get him to hush up because here he was betraying
mm-hmm.
what he had probably been taught
mm-hmm.
at home,
mm-hmm.
you see. And to describe myself, I'm about 200 pounds. I'm about 6'2 in my boots. I'm wearing dreadlocks, and at that time they were wrapped in bandana, but you could see the dreads. And so the images that he has been fed of what Blackness is
mm-hmm.
was expressed in that moment. And I can't even begin to explain to you the feeling. It was such an uncanny mix of feelings, standing there watching this little boy helplessly screaming,
that the monster
hiding between his mother's legs from me, I, monster, you see.
Mm-hmm.
And I still examine, I'm still in the process of examining that, because at the same time that it was shocking to me, and I felt a mix of anger because the woman who would probably, who would probably be a feminist. See, there are these cultural assumptions that someone following one cause is automatically going to be empathetic with you on another level. And that's not necessarily true
mm-hmm.
when we talk about our popular issues. And so there was a mix of emotion. One, it was sort of exhilarating. On the other hand, the idea of having the power to inspire that kind of fear, and that is a power.
It is a power.
And this is something, it seemed to me that at that moment, the dialogue between white America and black America was crystallized for me in some way that I'm still, you know, examining, that I'm constantly examining in my work, in my poetry when I write.
But, you know, what I think is interesting, and after this I'd like you to perhaps read a poem, not necessarily that examine the similar kind of issue that as black people we are confronted with, but the problem with that power relationship is the power you have is a power, in a sense, which makes you targeted. Because if you're a monster, then you're to be eliminated.
Well, but that's the point. It's there's no way around it. You see, that's what the kicker is. That's the killer. There isn't any way around it. That's what happened with Rodney King.
Exactly.
Okay. And having had similar experiences driving through the streets of Los Angeles and understanding how intense the heat being the police and law enforcement, and how unjust and unfair it is, because there is no peace and there is no justice, it's unavoidable.
Exactly.
When you're highly
visible,
which used to be the joke, the running gag of visibility, and it's still too true. And here I am experiencing it all these years after the passage of this amendment and that amendment.
Which hasn't done anything.
Absolutely. Every time we make some sort of gain or we think that we have resolved the problem, we're faced with these reversals. Or are the ground that we've lain is somehow stolen back from us. And we have to keep fighting this war
over and over.
And that's what the title of my book, African Sleeping Sickness, means, because there is a form of California encephalitis that was going around in the 50s, and I came down with this. And when I was studying about encephalitis, I discovered that it's caused by a virus that every time, you know, it's carried by the tsetse tsetse fly. And in an attempt to cure it or eradicate it, it keeps metamorphing. It changes constantly. And to me, that was the metaphor for racism as we approach it. Every time we think we finally got the message across, we finally cured this disease, it takes on other characteristics. And, you know, like the Andromeda, to me, the Andromeda Syndrome, the movie where they're trying to find the virus and the virus keeps shifting. Well, to me, that's the same process that blacks undergo in this nation when we're dealing with white America.
Can we have a poem from that collection?
Sure.
I'm talking with Wanda Coleman, and she's going to be reading a poem.
Since we're on the subject of viruses, this one's called A Civilized Plague. A friend and I were discussing the local scarcity of decent apartments, yet the abundance of high-priced hellholes. She complained the only good ones at reasonable rates are units in which the occupant has died of the virus. Occasionally, we hear what sounds like footsteps on the ceiling. The joke is, it's the ghost. And we remember the guy who lived here before us. He died of the virus. It is because of this we suspect. We were able to rent so quickly and easily without a credit check. A friend and traveler says they're beginning to deny visas to residents of Los Angeles, New York, and San Francisco. I was working, struggling to concentrate, depressed about money madness, when my matters were interrupted by the crescendoing hallelujahs of Handel's Messiah issuing vigorously from my neighbor's stereo. It is rumored he has the virus.
Wanda Coleman. Wanda, let's continue our discussion along that poem in terms of virus, in terms of racism in America, in terms of yourself as an African-American woman navigating and, in a sense, raising those issues or trying to give a kind of historical perspective to those issues in your poetry. What is the process by which you, in a sense, transform your experience as an African-American in a racist society into the poetry?
Well, that seems to become a rather unconscious process for me now. At one time, I felt that I had to write the poem and then sort of put the blackness in it. You know, and that was kind of artificial. Now it just comes, as it were, and I'm not worried about that anymore. It's there one way or the other. Mm-hmm. There's no way to elude that. So I don't worry about that. But what my poems, when they come to me as a line, as a circumstance, for example, thinking about being a monster,
you know,
I imagine that's working its way through my psyche, and that the poem will make itself manifest at some point. And I feel so comfortable with the process that I'm not even in a hurry to sit down and write the poem, because I know that when it comes, if I'm on the freeway, you know, I always carry a notebook with me somewhere. If I'm standing in line at the supermarket, when it starts making itself felt, the lines will start coming, and I'll start scribbling them, and voila, there's the poem. Or I'll be in the middle of writing something else, and it'll start to emerge. And when I know myself well enough, when I recognize the emergence, I'll start documenting it. You know, I'm just going to start writing it some way.
I think that's important what you say, and in fact, it's the same similar thing with me, but I find whenever I speak to students or young people who want to write or people who haven't been writing for a while, they talk about that, you know, and trying to dispel the whole thing of motivation and inspiration. And I think what you've said is important is the way in which you live with an idea. And so I want, my next question was to perhaps for you to talk a little bit more, to continue on that same length in terms of your process as a writer.
Well, I'm also a deadline writer. I write on several levels. In other words, I write I've done script writing, and I have a script agent, and I'm always running around Hollywood somewhere pitching my storyline. So I do that. That's one aspect of what I do. I'm also a contributing editor at this point to the Los Angeles Times Magazine, and I share a column with two other writers, and I have every third column. Then I'm, of course, function as a volunteer broadcaster for Pacifica. So I wear all these numerous hats besides being a poet in performance, where I read my work in public quite a bit. And I'm continually talking, giving talks, lectures. I'm also teaching as a visiting writer at the Claremont Colleges right now. That's just about wrapped up. And I'm going to be writing a libretto for an opera. So I do a number of kinds of writing. And each one has its own demands. And so I find that I have to more or less compartmentalize. The journalism needs processes. The process of journalism, you handle your information quite differently than you handle your information when you're writing a poem. When you're writing a short story, you handle the information differently. I do book reviews from time to time. I write essays. I've been writing a number of essays quite recently. And I like creative essays. I don't write academic essays. I write creative essays, and I enjoy those. I have one recently published in The Nation. And so what I find is that just the sheer volume of the different kinds of writing that I do, it's like keeping the cogs well oiled.
Okay.
And so I find that I have to really have in my mind a clear idea of the demands of each form and understand each form thoroughly so that I don't confuse them.
And what understanding do you bring to poetry?
Well, outside of the understanding of just the sheer craft, technical understanding that you can get in courses in colleges, I think I also bring a way of looking at things, a way of perception, perceiving things, and I think that that's what really ultimately makes the poet who they are. Your vision, what you see, how you see, and that you're clear on how you see it. And for example, I remember around 1979, 81, when the Eula Love incident went down in Los Angeles. Eula Love was a woman who had the misfortune of getting into an altercation with police, and she was killed. And she had wielded a knife at them, and they, instead of subduing her, as they could have done, or shooting her in the leg, in other words, instead of doing something where you're just going to maim someone and get them out of the way and then subdue them, they killed her. And there was a large outcry in the community. And this was around the time of Jonestown also. Mm-hmm. And so a small item appeared in the Times, one of these little columns, you know, you see
obscure.
Them all the time, you know, one of these little columns, and, you know, it's about, you know, 1 or 2 inches. And I cut this thing out and I sent it to, I cried when I read it. And I cut it out and I sent it with a letter to my friend, I had a friend in Norway, and I was saying, this is what, you know, this, look at what they're doing to us. And I was pointing out to how to read the what's encoded in the text. What it, you know, you read these things that are in this purportedly objective, reportage,
mm-hmm.
and this always happens when the subject is a black individual.
Exactly.
This so-called text that isn't supposed to be slanted, but it is very
obviously
slanted.
So. Mm-hmm.
And so I began to fill in the gaps between the lines. Now, this process has become a part of my poetic process over the years. I even have some poems in African Sleeping Sickness and in my latest book, Hand Dance,
mm-hmm.
where specific incidents, in fact, I'll share this with you. This was actually one of those little paragraphs.
Okay.
And I really got upset. Let me see if I can find it here. I really got upset and when I saw this. And so I decided to turn it into a poem.
So then you are in fact being a griot. You are filling out the story. You are making sure
exactly,
the stories live.
That the story is told the way it really happened. In other words, for me, and I think this is true of most black writers, the only place we can tell the truth is in our fiction.
That's right.
Because we're not allowed to tell our truth in the real world, in reality. You can't turn on television and see our truth, you know. And that's the horror of being black in America in this century.
Indeed.
You know, everyone else is allowed to tell their truth except us, you see. So this is one of those pieces. It's a poem called David Polion. An 11-year-old boy was fatally wounded one Sunday night by a bullet fired into his home. He was taken to the hospital, pronounced dead, a victim of a drive-by shooting. The gangsters didn't even know they'd killed him, shooting away, stupid, jobless, ignorant, hopeless, shooting for kicks. This 11-year-old black boy, the same age as my youngest, was identified by a relative, his cousin said. We were in the living room dancing. He was standing, watching. We heard the shot. He ran to the kitchen and collapsed and began crawling. This 11-year-old black boy, the same age, same race, my son, was shot and killed Sunday night when a bullet was fired into his home. He ran into the kitchen and collapsed. The bullet traveled 100 yards before smashing into the living room. It passed through a window near the family's recently decorated Christmas tree. He ran into the kitchen and collapsed. An 11-year-old boy was fatally wounded Sunday night. A child, the same age as my son, and I'm crying as though I am his mother.
And you are. That poem gives me the chill.
Well, to me, that's what's happening. America's been killing our children. It's been killing us from the jump. The lives of our children have no value.
And they know it.
That's right. And when our children die, they're put on the back columns. They don't matter. They're not significant. And I'm extremely angry about that. Extremely angry. I know my anger knows no end.
Mm-hmm.
My rage knows no boundaries about our children being killed. When Latasha Harlins was killed, and this was one of the incidents that coupled with the Rodney King, the verdict in the Rodney King case, led to Los Angeles burning last April. Whenever anything happens to a white child in Southern California, you can bet your bottom dollar.
Yes.
It makes front page news.
That's right.
You see. Now, we have a lot of young men making the front page news now, but it's all related to gang violence, and it's usually crimes where they have committed against dominant culture people, see?
Mm-hmm.
But if something happens to one of our children, it's consigned to the back pages.
Like we're consigned to the back pages of America.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
I'm Opal Palmer-Dees, and I'm talking with Wanda Coleman, who is the author of several books, among them Mad Dog, Black Lady, Heavy Daughter Blues, A War of Eyes and Other Stories, The Dixborough Hotel, African Sleeping Sickness, and her newest collection, Hand Dance. The poem that Wanda just read is a poem which is very much an issue with many of us who are writers and many of us who are mothers. One of the strengths for me in that piece is that you, like I, we are mothers, and so you personalize it. You lay claim to that child. And I know that you're a community organizer, and I wanted you to talk a little bit about community organizing and your poetry and being a mother, because while they might be viewed as three distinct roles, you have integrated them. And one of the things about that poem that brings tears and goosebumps to my arms is because you make me feel it as a mother. And I think somehow our experiences in America have desensitized us and have made it so that we no longer take responsibility for each other. Could you talk a little bit about your community organizing and how it intersects with your poetry?
Well, the most recent project that I did was, that came about through my poetry and through my dialogue with a number of young black artists in South Central, was a special issue of High Performance Magazine. In fact, I had the pleasure of being able to be up here towards the end of last fall, and some of the CD we played over the air here at KPFA. And this was put together in summer during curfew, and came out around, we had our first issues by the end of June. It was called The Violence and the Verdict, and it was a project that involved over 125 artists and writers from across Southern California. And the project grew specifically out of a dialogue between a group that called themselves the Black Avant-Garde, and their concerns about who were they, how were they in Southern California, what value did they have?
Mm-hmm.
And these are the questions that generation after generation our artists and writers keep asking, keep trying to define ourselves, trying to figure out what aesthetic is going to finally be the medicine, the cultural medicine that's going to solve our problems in this country, give some clues to the rest of us, you know, some sort of stratagem, how we're gonna figure this thing out. And I was invited to attend the meeting, which was taking place at Beyond Baroque, which is an art center in Venice, near the beach. And I went there, and there happened to be a number of other people there, too, just because people wanted to talk. That was one of the interesting things that happened after the violence and during that curfew time. No one had wanted to talk. You know, the past 12 years during the Reagan-Bush years, racism has been really on the back burner, and no one in any part of the city wanted to discuss, even our the usual places where such a dialogue would go on, among the white liberal parts of the city, even they didn't want to hear it. You know, well, we did our part. We don't need to talk to you right now about this. There are other things, other issues. Mm-hmm. So the anger and the rage was festering. And if you would go to a party or a Bray and Sheezer, no one wanted to talk. You know, everything was its usual la-la-la superficiality. Mm-hmm. No one wanted to really discuss what was really going on in the city. And when LaTosha Harlins happened, there was really no support of the black community. All the liberal quarters were silent.
Okay.
None of the other parts of the community wanted to talk about that. And I was one of the few people who was very vocal about that. I mean, I take the opportunity. One of the ways that I consider myself an activist is I constantly have a forum when I'm invited to read my poetry. And so I take that time to make those kinds of statements or comments at that moment. But this was a specific project that came out of that kind of dialogue during curfew. And the editor, Steve Durlin of High Performance, was kind enough to offer us a form, said, well, hey, if we want to do some sort of manifesto, but we didn't know what that was going to be or how that was going to take place. But we felt that some sort of statement had to be made. And it took off from there, and it metamorphed, it took on its own energy. And I decided that maybe the job to do at that point was to document the energy.
Right.
Not necessarily to make a specific political statement, because no one seemed to be able to articulate it at that moment.
But in a sense, documenting.
The confusion, the desire to dialogue, the hurt. There was a lot of pain and hurt and disappointment and disillusion. There was such a mix of emotions that was coming out at that time. And so I felt that it was important to at least get it down. Document in a raw way, a way that was uncensored and that didn't go through the usual kind of sense of, you know, when newspapers
editing
get finished with
filtering.
Something, you know, yeah, mm-hmm. Exactly. So that was, I wanted to get it out because I knew that the situation was going to be exploited. You know, the clowns were going to jump into airplanes and fly into Los Angeles, you know, a la Ted Koppel.
Right.
And the whole gang was going to come flying in and start looking at this. Now, you couldn't get anybody to talk about L.A. You know, I found, I understand it. I understand the anti-L.A. feeling that has been, you know, it's really not directed so much at Los Angeles itself as it is Hollywood and the image machine.
Right.
So I appreciate that. And when I go to other communities across America, when I get off the plane, I find that people look at, you know, are very negative and hostile towards Los Angeles. And so you couldn't get people to talk about L.A. If you tried to tell them what was going on, they didn't want to hear it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they might even just... you know, walk away from you without even saying anything to
mm-hmm.
you, you know, very rudely and making their feelings felt. Now, here they come. Here come all our, you know,
leaders we didn't know existed.
Armchair exploiters, all our armchair looters
mm-hmm.
are coming into town to get in on the action because now all of a sudden it's hot. And then we have all of us people of color can work. All our spokespeople like Mike Davis, for example.
Mm-hmm.
Now, you know, when no one wanted to hear what you had to say in 1990, can't get enough of it in 1993. So it's very strange, this strange sort of carnivorous thing that's happening, this feed that's going on right now. I mean, many of the local artists are suffering what I call demand stress paralysis. There's not enough, you know, everyone's writing grants. Everyone's doing the hustle.
Right.
Because they smell opportunity.
Mm-hmm.
And what isn't happening is that the real root causes aren't being examined. The issues aren't being addressed. As far as I'm concerned, the riot never stopped.
That's
still
right.
going on. The riot never stopped.
What I think is interesting, Wanda, and I wonder if you wanted to talk a little bit about that, is the way in which they are, in a sense, gearing up for what they think might be another riot, depending on the verdict.
Well, since they haven't done anything to really prevent it. You know, that what they've done is, you know, one of the things they did during the violence, there are certain shortcut streets that you can take that you can get from parts of L.A. that sort of facilitate, if you know the streets and don't take the freeway, sometimes you can get across town faster than people who are on the freeway. Some of those streets have been cordoned off.
Mm-hmm.
And remain so.
Uh-huh.
Okay? They remain so. And they barricaded Parker Center the other day. I got so tickled about that. And one of the candidates for mayor came out and started screaming, "Let's bring in the National Guard as a preventative to be preventive," which they're mobilizing right now
to do.
And I really think that's unfortunate. I think that really tells you because what Southern California is about,
mm-hmm.
where the Nazis wear three-piece suits, where we have the Klan on computerized underground, where blacks are being pushed out of the city because you have this computerized network that keeps us from getting an adequate housing, okay? So they haven't done anything about opening up housing. When you go downtown and you look, one of the disparaging things about looking at the glut of homelessness is that invariably the skin color, it is a sea of ebony.
Mm-hmm.
A sea of it. When you go downtown and when you go into those the areas where they've tried to gentrify,
mm-hmm.
and you look at the color of the people who are homeless, you know, there's a real reason for that. When I was little, when all the homeless people were white males.
Mm-hmm. That's right. Certainly the face of homelessness have changed.
Absolutely. And no one seems to be interested in examining what the specific reasons are. There are no linkages made. Our issues are always presented as though they popped out of a vacuum somewhere. When you talk about that there are so many young black women who are becoming single parents, well, Bill Moyers kicked off that discussion, but his discussion of it was so superficial. And I really get tired of this man on the street approach to us,
yes.
that every black person is an authority on blackness. I mean, when dominant culture or people are examined, they go to their authorities. They
That's
talk
right.
to our authorities. But when they want to look at our issues, they go to just any Joe Blow on the street, and all of a sudden he's the designated authority,
mm-hmm.
you know? And I get so tired of that. I saw, I don't mean, when I tell this story, I don't mean to demean Mr. Bill Cosby, but I got very angry when I saw a PBS program one time, to give you an example. And they were talking about literary. The subject was literature.
Mm-hmm.
And they had literary people representing every group. This is one of these PC programs,
mm-hmm.
you know, politically correct, that PBS is so, not does ad nauseum. And so they had the, you know, the Chinese male, you know, the homosexual. They had the, you know, the white Jewish, you know, the Jewish female, the white female, the Chicano male, you know. So they had all the groups represented. But for us, for the black people, they only had one person, Bill Cosby. And I got so mad I wanted to kick the television in. I said, my God, look, how many black writers do you have now?
When
I mean,
does
you know,
he become an
shall
authority?
We go down the list? You know, and he may be an authority in his given area, but we were talking about literature here, the literary.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And how many of us have killed ourselves to publish our books, to try to get our voices heard, and yet when it comes to something like that, they're going to go Hollywood on us.
Right. Why don't we hear a poem that's kind of Southern California or that addresses the real people or some aspect of that?
This is a poem that was published in City Lights Review just before L.A. erupted, and it's called Notes of a Cultural Terrorist. After the war, war begins, war goes on. I am a soldier, look at my boots, soles worn from seeking work, from hours in unemployment lines. Call me a civilian casualty. The war to feed children, the war to clothe their backs, the war to meet the rent, the war to keep the gas tank full, the war to end the calculated madness keeping the poor poor. What happens to a war deferred? Does it implode? Does repressed aggression ravage the collective soul? There's rioting now. I see the blaze, red smoke rising. The city burns. People are looting, taking things, all the excess denied them. Crimes of possession to have without the onus of color or fear of rejection. Children carry racks of clothes. Women push shopping carts brimming with food. Men favor liquor stores and gun shops. But what we need is revolution, bloodless or otherwise. We must go deeper than lust gratified in one spontaneous, torrid upsurge of rage. I am a soldier. Look at my hair, fallen out under stress. The many hours unappreciated on the job, not even a decent chair. Call me collateral damage. And when all the foreign battles are won, will we who battle here at home have our day in democracy's sun? I am a soldier, but my back is broke, battling the papers I push all day. My hope is broke too. How do I love? Call me politically correct. What happens to a war deferred? Does it seep down into the skin, a rash of discontent to erupt again and again?
Wanda Coleman speaking with Opal Palmer-Disa. For those of us who, and I imagine the world, couldn't help but be aware of the Rodney King incidents, there's all those images that commercial media popularized on. And I want to talk a little bit about the craft of that poem, in terms of, I really think it's important that writers and poets be critic of their own work, as well as the critics who say various other things about the work. And certainly what I hear, apart from the kind of narrative recounting of giving a different side to the taking of things, the historical side, the political, racist, discriminatory side, also I couldn't help but think of Langston Hughes's What Happens to a Dream Deferred.
Absolutely.
And I like the way, in fact, you have reversed that, or that you've changed it. But in a sense, it issues the same kind of warning or the same kind of question that Langston raised. Can you talk a little bit about your form and those African-American poets or other poets outside of African-American?
Well, that was my nod to Langston Hughes. And I feel that as a black poet, that I have two traditions here. I'm bicultural. I have my indigenous, black, griot tradition, right, as a part of the diaspora, as a black of slave origin, that I feel I'm entitled to that. But I'm a whole new animal. I'm a black of slave origin. I've been cut off from Africa. I am really an American. I grew up, I never knew what soul food was till I was an adult. My mother was a domestic. She worked in the Stars home in Hollywood, you know. She cooked for Ronald Reagan and Jane Wyman when they were married. I grew up eating the same food they ate.
Mm-hmm.
So I never knew what soul food was. We had roast beef on Sundays instead of fried chicken.
Okay.
You know, and mashed potatoes and gravy. So I was raised very much in the Western tradition. Okay? We went to the black AME church. You know. I went to the Philharmonic. I learned about classical music. I was raised to be a debutante. I had ballet lessons. If you can imagine.
quite a large ballerina.
I mean, this is what my mother, oh, yeah, absolutely. That's, you know, I never could get on my toes. But, I mean, that was the kind of, so I am a very much a product of this culture. And so I feel that I'm entitled fully to create whatever in a jazz-like fashion, any kind of fusion I so desire. Mm-hmm. And that I'm as much entitled to tap into Walt Whitman as I am to tap into Langston Hughes, you know, or even go back across the Niger. You know what I'm saying? So I feel very comfortable mm-hmm. sampling from both of my heritages, and I have no problem going back and forth. And I think we're seeing more and more of that, especially when we have such a large immigrant population of people from so many places coming in into our society. And I think that when you start getting to the third and the second and third generation, that's what you're going to get. You're going to get the kind of psyche that reshapes the language, that reshapes the culture, and, you know, which is very, and the language, which is very fluid, is a fluid process, mm-hmm. is an ongoing process, you know, which is also another thing that I like about rap and hip hop, is the way that we repossess this language. This language keeps telling us, well, you're supposed to speak in this way, you're supposed to speak in that way. And we go back and we take it and we kick it.
We certainly do.
One of the problems I have had, I had a friend ask me the other day, say, you're not a feminist, are you? And I said, I'm a meta-feminist, you know,
can
if you
can
get to that.
That?
And, well, I think that there is in the world a female principle that is equally powerful to the male principle and in no way subservient to it and doesn't have to argue about it, you understand me, or justify its existence. It just simply is, if you can get to that. And so this has been my approach in my writing. I don't feel necessarily that I have to lay out an argument. And what I find unattractive about a lot of feminist literature, for example, I was reading to my class at Pitzer College, I was reading an Erica Young essay. And as I began to read the essay, I started arguing with it. And I was saying, well, the statements she's making here follow such a narrow agenda. Mm-hmm. And it certainly ignores my existence, as though I do not exist. And that's been one of the problems with a lot of feminist thought. It assumes a posture, a very narrow perspective, that this is the only perspective that's of any value to talk about. And doesn't consider that there are women in this world who have other kinds of experiences.
And who should be allowed to have other experiences
should be allowed to articulate
those experiences.
And when you're made aware of those other experiences, that should broaden the dialogue so that the feminist dialogue becomes broader and broader and, you know, and more inclusive. And unfortunately, someone like Anita Hill becomes used.
Indeed.
They become used as in the same way that Shaw, in his essay, A Black Girl in Search for God, used the black girl as like a ruler or an indicator with no concern whatsoever as to what a black girl really might be about in her search for God, you see. Mm-hmm. And so, and likewise, a sort of truncated feminist movement seized upon Anita Hill without really understanding what that was going on between a black woman and a black man in a public arena,
right.
And understanding how our relationships have been affected by our servitude in this nation, and really not seeing what kind of, you know, turning this thing into a clown show, because it was already enough of a clown show as it was.
Yeah, I think what is also unfortunate is that Anita Hill as a woman has not really been examined.
That's right. Or what it even, our relationships, there's so much, the dominant culture knows so little about us and has examined us to such a limited extent that they have no way of really understanding what was going on.
Yeah.
You know, and that was really an insult to us that she should be used in this way, mm-hmm. you know, as suddenly to start, to jumpstart once more feminist dialogue.
And for their own agenda, and this is a particular...
That's a bogus approach. I mean, there could have been a proper approach. That could have been done in a way that complemented both agendas. Mm-hmm. And I think that's where the dialogue is going to have to go as we move forward. Hopefully, we are going to move forward.
Well, I think people like you and your work are going to make sure, or certainly going to try to make sure that happens.
That's what it's about.
Wanda, I want to ask one other quick question, although it might not be a quick answer.
Okay.
And to have you end reading perhaps one other poem. In terms of your writing, we talked earlier that you live with an idea, like this monster idea that you're living with, which I know is going to produce a very wonderful poem. And when it comes, you'll be ready because you walk around with the necessary things to record those moments. Can you talk a little bit about your writing, apart from that kind of idea or other ideas that you live with? Is that the normal process or the kind of general process that your writing takes, that something happens and sometimes you might respond to it instantly depending on, you know, the situation? Or do you tend to live with an idea before and then it comes wherever?
Well, I find that usually if you write immediately behind an experience, if you write it down that first rush, sometimes it works and sometimes it doesn't. Sometimes you just have to work, you'll be in situations where you have to just work the poem out, and you just have to sit there and wrestle with it and go through draft after draft after draft. Then there's the poem that just comes like it's a gift. It just writes itself. And then there are the ideas that have to germinate and just have to be around. And sometimes that initial, what you write the first time, is dissatisfactory. It doesn't work. And what I found over time is that when a poem doesn't work, that you never really lose your poems. When it comes to you and it doesn't work this time, you'll find yourself maybe 10 years down the line, all of a sudden writing out of the same source, material. And here comes the poem now that you were groping and struggling to try to get 10 years ago, and voila, here it just suddenly is there for you. And you say, oh, wow. And when you go back and say, I wrote this before somehow, and you go back and you look through your notebooks, which I have a tendency to keep everything, just about everything I've written, and you go back and you look and you say, oh, yes, that was this idea way back then. In other words, the earlier stuff, the initial rush stuff, is almost like a note to yourself, so that the key might be the key to the poem that's to come. So I have a tendency to keep, if I write something initially after experience and it doesn't work, I won't throw it away. I'll just keep it, because I find that usually that's the key that unlocks the poem to come. And if I'm just thumbing through my old notebooks and just kind of casually looking, all of a sudden the poem might just jump out at me.
Mm-hmm.
You know?
And then you write it,
and
you
I
perform
it.
Let's hear one more, please.
Okay, let me close with this one. I think this is
Wanda Coleman.
A nice little poem. It's called, and it's kind of like a cry. It's called Jazz Waz. My heart in my ear, his baby. We need to talk jazz later, as in after the rain. Sleeping in the ghost of his arms, the essence of a beard tickling the roots of his wag about jobs not gotten and the life I'd live if only you'd get with it. Jazz couldn't fill enough hours trying to avoid the phone which did not ring, the letter that didn't arrive, the love that was not stolen in sufficient quantities. Oh, I said, and oh, the mirror answers each time we pretend you are never on my mind.
I think that's quite an appropriate end. This is Opal Palmer Adisa speaking with Wanda Coleman. She just read from her new collection, Hand Dance. Wanda, thanks very much.
Thank you, Opal.